Welcome to the Physics Teaching Podcast, the podcast for teachers of physics, made by physics teachers. Welcome to the Physics Teaching Podcast. My name is Thomas WP, a part-time A-level only teacher of physics.
And my name's Robin Griffiths, and I'm a former physics teacher who now works for the Institute of Physics, although I have to stress that all my views are my own and not necessarily those of the Institute.
Yes, we did it at the start. I don't believe it. That must be a first.
We're only, 25 episodes in or whatever, and we finally got it right.
How's your Easter been?
Yeah, my Easter's been lovely. I went to my cousin's wedding in Tuscany, which was just a beautiful and joyous event and a lovely celebration of love and optimism and all that's good in the world.
Oh, what an optimistic time. I've been to a wedding too of one of my ex-pupils, who's now a science teacher. And she taught my daughter, but she's now moved to a new school. So that was a very joyous occasion.
Oh, that's lovely. That is nice.
So, physics in the news. Have you perhaps noticed any major physics news in the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, there was something, and all I could think is I got distracted and just thought, donut. Yeah, the first picture of a black hole.
Yeah.
Which surprised me, I have to say, because you'd have thought that somebody would have pictured this type of thing before. And so that got me thinking that, well, what were they picturing exactly? Were they picturing Hawking radiation, or what were they imaging in that image? And actually what it was, it's just the radiation from the accretion disk.
Yeah, I think it's the stuff screaming into the black hole, these phenomenal speeds. Wasn't it the way up they released the picture, the bottom was a bit brighter than the top, so that gave them an idea of which way it was screaming around this black hole. But when I was a kid, black holes were just an idea. This is how old I am. They were just an idea. They weren't proven. And through my career, I took a school trip to the Cavendish Labs in Cambridge. And there they showed us some pictures they'd taken of the centre of our galaxy with some suns doing these incredible ellipses, screaming in, doing a really hard handbrake turn around something we couldn't see and shooting out again. And that was...
yes.
Maybe a black hole, but it could have just been something very dense. But this is a real photograph of a real black hole, and that's why it's special.
I think what they're doing is because the accretion disk, the matter around it, is rotating so quickly, and the friction between the particles in that accretion disk is causing the glow. So it's such a huge black hole that you can actually pick up that glow, whereas the black hole in the centre of our galaxy perhaps is too small and you can't pick up the glow because it's being swamped by other light or it's just too dim to see, is my guess. But I need to find it. Maybe you, dear listener, know what it's all about.
Yes, I think the reason they can't see the black hole at the centre of our galaxy is because there are clouds of dust in the way and the light can't get through. I can't remember what frequency they saw these stars.
Yeah.
But what really intrigued me was the way they saw this distant black hole, because I saw an XKCD cartoon, which I'll link to in the show notes, that had the scale of this black hole. And the black bit of the picture, that is about as far as Voyager will have travelled from planet Earth, which is effectively in my lifetime.
Brilliant.
So it's a tiny object. I mean, given how far away it is, it's a tiny object. And they saw it by making a telescope as big as the Earth. And I remember being taught that at school, and not really understanding, and they're saying the bigger the telescope, the finer the resolution you can have. So if we wanted human eyesight to be better, we could have huge eyes the size of dinner plates, but we'd have to have a smaller brain and a bigger head. They have sensors, obviously telescopes, on each end of the world, and then they had to pull in the data from there and do some crazy calculations to make it think it was one telescope. And wasn't there a non-physicist, Katie Bauman, who led the algorithm? That's a great story. She's a postdoc at is it MIT? She just got involved because it was interesting, I think.
It's great that one of the nice things about this story, I thought, was that there was a female scientist who worked on it, and people highlighted that and said, yeah, look, you know, women scientists, because this seems to be the experience is that there are huge numbers of women scientists working out there who just never get heard from, and whatever reason that is, inherent sexism is probably part of it, but also that women don't promote themselves as heavily as men do generally, and so, you know, that women work and contribution to science doesn't get recognized as much as it should, and it's lovely to see that happening here.
It is lovely, and I love the picture that was tweeted out of her looking absolutely flabbergasted as her laptop, pulled in the data and looked at the result of the algorithm and showed this black hole appearing. And you can, I love the photo because you can see her window of code, and there's a proper blackboard behind her with all sorts of stuff, graphs on it, with straight lines, which would make me happy. And it's just interesting to see the room where this amazing discovery was found was just like any office room anywhere that I've ever been in.
Yeah, it's lovely. And I saw the picture of her posing with the hard drives, some of the hard drives that had the data, because there's a huge amount of data that had to come in, wasn't there? Something like half a ton of hard drives or something.
There was a brilliant picture of her alongside one of the I can't remember her name, but one of the moonshot calculators. I can't remember her name, but she was standing next to a pile of paper that she used for the moonshot, and it was as tall as her. Then there was Katie Bowman with this pile of hard disks, but the pile of hard disks was a small fraction of the data that she had to work with. And to her credit, though, she did say, yeah, it's me, but 200 other people worked on this, and she kept repeating that, which I thought was good as well.
Yeah, and it's interferometry, of course, and that ties back quite nicely to A-level physics. You know, the N lambda equals D sine theta, the idea of interferometry, that you can look at some very, very, very fine details by looking at the broad interference pattern that you get from them at a great distance.
Yes, harking back to our diffraction episode. Now, we've had a few people email us, haven't we, Robin? And we were going to thank them and give them a bit of feedback, and it does lead nicely into our next Ways to Teach episode. Firstly, Ian Smith contacted us about some stuff he's done on the Scottish Hires, gave us a bit of information about that, and we've added him to our link of physics websites.
Thanks, Ian.
And in the same vein, Seamus Smith contacted us about technicians, and that led to me making a new links to pages for technicians as well as the pages for physics teachers.
Mm.
So thank you, Seamus. He linked us to Techno, which has a directory of sites that are useful to teachers and technicians that dwarfs ours. So I would definitely go there.
Again, wonderful technician. Thank you, Seamus. Hero. We're not worthy. Thank you.
Certainly not. And then we had Jonathan Shaw, who describes himself as a NQT late-stage career through Now Teach, and he had a couple of points which definitely made me think. One of them was the practicals in memoriam are great, but if you're not that experienced, you don't know what to do. So that made me think, ooh, maybe I should write a blog post and explain them better, or maybe ask the person we interviewed to give a bit more detail. So we'll definitely take that on board. He also had a question which I don't think we can go into now, but it was, when you're teaching electricity, should you talk about electrons or charge? Thank you, Jonathan. That was great and really made us think. Mm. And Jonathan also bought us a coffee. He went to the.physicsteachingpodcast.com/shop and he bought us a coffee. Thank you very much.
Great. I think it'd be great to get Jonathan on at some stage and talk, because I always think it's really interesting, people who've worked in other fields and then work in teaching and the perspectives they have. It's really interesting, because it'd be lovely to given he's done the Now Teach thing, it'd be great to get him on and to talk about that at some stage in the future. It might be a nice thing to do.
And then finally, Cara Wood, who sent us an absolutely one of those brilliant practicals, Robin, you just want to immediately do, and again, within a minute of getting her email. Thank you, Cara. I was trying it out, and I'm not going to say what it is, because it links into what will be our next Ways to Teach ... episode.
And the next Ways to Teach episode will be
waves.
Thank you. I know, it's not Ridley Scott, is it? But hey.
So the next Ways to Teach episode, which is not going to be episode 30, because we're going to do them a bit more frequently, is going to be the week before half term in the UK. So that'll be episode 28 in 5 episodes time. So if you could share with us your Ways to Teach ... waves, that would be great. The best way is on Twitter, and we'd really like people to use the hashtag, because it really helps us find them. And the hashtag we would like people to use is #TPTPWaves. That's #TPTPWaves.
So if you've got a really, really good way of teaching waves, and you, it's something you use, just a little tip or technique, something that helps the kids to their understanding, anything at all, doesn't matter how big, how small, whether it's a practical, whether it's a theoretical thing, whether it's a model, whether it's a demo or a simulation, doesn't matter what, just #TPTPWaves, let us know.
Great. And our guest this week has a brilliant Waves practical, which is his practical memoriam, and we're going to play it in that episode. And that's a nice segue into this week's episode, which you trailed forward, segue and trailed forward in the same sentence, which you trailed forward last episode, which is Alam Shahar. Would you please introduce Alam, and then we'll play the interview.
Lovely, yes. Alam Shahar, what a star he is. He's a science communicator, he's a dad, he's a physics practicing physics teacher as well, works down in London. But all in all, a great guy and a great activist for inclusive education and all sorts of other things besides. So it was a real pleasure to catch up with him. And of course, not least, we should remember, he is also an author of a fantastic book. One of Alam's key principles, which he talks about early on, is just something that I really, really, really love. And it's something, if we could communicate that widely, would just be brilliant. So before I completely and utterly tell us everything that's going to go on in the interview, let's just hear from him, shall we?
I am a physics teacher with about 20 years experience in the classroom, which is a bit scary. And I currently work part-time at a comprehensive school in London. And I spend the rest of my life mostly taking care of my two young children, but occasionally trying to write books and other things like that.
The book you've written, Recipes for Wonder, is just fabulous. What a great book. Can you tell us a bit about it and who it's kind of aimed at and what the idea of it was?
Thanks very much. Yeah, that's very kind of you. I wrote a book for parents to do science activities at home with their children, and it was a consequence of working with the Royal Institution on a video series which had the same goal. I was hired by the Royal Institution to make some films for them, which they hoped would help and encourage parents to do science at home in much the same way that, you know, parents do arts and crafts or music or writing activities at home. We wanted to provide a resource that would help parents engage their children with science in the same way.
That's great. And I there's a great quote that you'll know which one this is about parents.
Well, I don't know if you're talking about the fact that parents are their children's first teachers, but that's what I believe. I think it's very obvious that the first place where children start learning anything is in the home. And, you know, it's common for children to learn how to read at home, to learn how to play musical instruments, to start experimenting with art and so forth. And I don't think there should be any reason why it shouldn't be the same for science.
And I think that's something that's going to resonate with teachers so much is this idea that you know, it's at home where this a science capital is built, isn't it, really?
Yeah, so that was something else that kind of informed my work in the last couple of years, this new idea of science capital, if you like. You know, I'm from a background where arguably I had no science capital. You know, there weren't any doctors or engineers in my family. I didn't really know what science was as a child, I don't think. And my parents certainly couldn't have explained it to me. But, you know, through a remarkably good education, I've gone on to do a science degree, a physics degree, and become a science teacher and reap the benefits of a great science education. So, you know, I guess I'm an anomaly according to that kind of research, which is, you know, despite having grown up with virtually no science capital, I have become a science professional in some shape or form.
Definitely. Well, teaching science is doing science, as my boss always tells me. So it's a good thing. And I was going to, and this was right. I mean, obviously, we're talking to hopefully teachers of science, people who are teaching physics, be they chemistry specialists, biology specialists, be they PE teachers or whatever. Those heroic people who teach physics out of specialism because there is no one else to do it. But in talking to them, what sort of things? How might they help to get that message to parents to that, you know, that they should be encouraging their kids to engage with science? How, you know, if you're talking to them at parents' evening, how might you encourage them to increase their kids' science capital?
I mean, I'm really trying to target primary aged children because the evidence suggests that, you know, by the time they get to secondary school, their ideas about science have been largely fixed. And to me, it seems that just as with reading, it's really important to get kids when they're young. I think attempting to help children think about the world and look at the world scientifically is something that we have to do from really preschool. So, you know, what I would say to my colleagues in secondary education is that if they're meeting parents at parents' evening and so forth, and they have younger siblings at primary school, then it's to encourage those parents to think about introducing their children to science and taking some responsibility for their science education at home. And really the way to do that is through, you know, activities like the kind I'm suggesting in my book. Of course, you know, other ways of increasing science capital is to take them to science museums and, you know, watch documentaries about science and so forth. But I do think that just as you might do an arts and crafts activity at home with your children or bake a cake or whatever, I think even if you're a parent with absolutely no scientific knowledge yourself, it is possible to use the resources out there to do a practical activity or to talk about the world in a scientific way if you just use the right resources. And obviously, I'd like to think that my book is one such resource.
What I loved about it was the readily available stuff that you might find lying around the house, you know, kit that you can get your hands on relatively easily and that you can use to elaborate science. Do you have a favourite from the book you might sort of give some context with?
The balloon racing cars have proved to be incredibly popular, and that's the one that lots of people kind of get back to me about. But, you know, I think the daffodil dissection, which is an activity that, you know, some children, if they're lucky, might do at primary school. And it's just, you know, it hasn't got any bangs or whizzes, but it's a very straightforward activity that I think encourages children to look at the world a bit more closely and embodies what scientists do in that sense, which is, I think scientists are people who just take a really deep interest in the physical world and look a bit more closely. And the daffodil dissection is so simple. You know, you can don't have to use a daffodil. You can use any flower. And what you're doing is kind of taking it apart to look at it more closely and see what's inside. And that, to me, it's the kind of activity you might not think to do. But once someone suggests it, it's really easy to do. And there's all sorts of interesting things to find out. You know, does the inside of the daffodil look the same as the inside of a tulip? What do they have in common? What's different? And then kind of go on from that to find out, well, why does a flower have all these bits? You know, and what does this bit do? And why is this bit sticky? And why is this bit shaped like this? There's lots you can do with such a simple activity. And, you know, what I'm trying to encourage parents to do is to not just do the activities, but talk to their children while they're doing them. And it's something that I've been, you know, talking about, banging on about before I wrote this book, in the context of practical work in schools. You know, the research suggests that, you know, teachers and students both enjoy practical work, but often practical work is a matter of following instructions so that you put some apparatus together in a particular manner and try to obtain a result that you know is what is supposed to happen. And so a lot of the time, you know, children's minds are focused on following the instructions and getting the right result, when in fact what practical work should be used for is to get them thinking about the scientific aspects of what they're doing. And in order to do that, teachers should be talking to students. You know, I remember being at school and being told that practical should be done in silence, and that's wrong. You know, if you're doing practicals in silence, then you're probably not discussing what's going on with anyone. You're certainly not discussing what's going on with anyone if it's done in silence. And you're probably not thinking about what is going on. You're probably focused on trying to follow instructions and so forth. So the phrase that I think other people have used as well is minds on as well as hands on. And, you know, in order to get children to be minds on, the simplest thing to do is to talk to them and ask them questions about what is going on. And parents can do that in the home just as science teachers like me ought to be doing it in the classroom. You know, why are you doing that? Why do you think that's happening? And what would happen if we changed this, or what would happen if we didn't use this particular piece of apparatus, and so forth. And I think that that's really at the heart of the book.
Yeah. And what I'm hearing here is it's about the joy of the discovery and the joy of uncovering the sort of nature's secrets, if you like, and you don't have to be an expert yourself to encourage your kids to do that.
Yes, and you know I'm very clear about the fact that, you know, children and whether it be in primary school or secondary school are not necessarily going to discover the laws of nature for themselves. But what we can start doing is getting them to ask the right kinds of questions, think about things like variables, fair testing, and trying to spot patterns in nature, you know, things that make a sound always have something that vibrates. So in this particular instance, what's vibrating? Let's think about that kind of thing. You know, I'm not a believer of the notion of kind of discovery learning. I don't think, for example, children will arrive at Newton's laws for themselves. So it's not so much about discovering scientific facts for themselves, but about learning how to ask scientific questions and how to look at things using what I would call a scientific methodology. And I'd be very careful. I don't want to suggest there is a single scientific method, but I do think that there are certain questions we can ask when we're doing practical work with young children that lead them towards looking at and thinking about the world scientifically.
You know, when you're talking to parents as a teacher, this is the sort of thing you encourage. Yes, you know, look at a book like Recipes for Wonder and look at some activities you can do with your kids. And who knows, you know, you might find yourself getting engaged in that process as well. And I mean, who wouldn't like to do that? That's what you described there, the daffodil dissection, a very seasonal time of year as well,
yes,
if I may say so. Very good. Is a really great thing that everybody in the family could get into, couldn't they? I mean, it sounds like a great, you know, afternoon activity, or maybe on a rainy April afternoon to do that in the kitchen on a chopping board would be a great thing to do.
That's right. I've tried to include activities in the book that are very straightforward, very cheap, involve little effort on the part of the parents. But also I have included things like, you know, making a balloon powered car, which is slightly more challenging, but possibly more fun and rewarding. It depends, you know, what parents feel like they want to do. And I hope I've included a range of activities that appeals to all parents.
Lovely. Recipes for Wonder. It's available on Amazon and in all good bookshops, I'm sure.
Yes. You know, I would encourage your listeners to use independent bookshops if they can.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Lest we lose them. Absolutely. So, yeah, don't get it from Amazon. Get it from your local independent bookshop. Very good. And, yeah, what a great prize that would be also to give away in school to kids and things like that. So look out for Alan's book. It is fantastic. You wear so many hats, Alan, that I could talk to you all afternoon, but I won't. Don't worry, before you hang up on me. But I did want to ask you about some videos, because you, in another life before teaching, you actually worked in sort of a production, didn't you? Is that right?
Yeah, I was a TV producer, but I came back to teaching and I wanted to use the skills that I'd learnt in television to help with my teaching and to help colleagues. And so I kind of stumbled into making films for teachers. So unlike a lot of what you might see on YouTube from other science teachers who are making kind of revision videos for students and so forth, my intention was to make videos that would help my colleagues and non-specialist physics teachers, particularly to teach physics in ways they might not have thought of. For example, you know, my great passion in science education is the use of demonstrations, and you know, I was very lucky that I had a chemistry and physics teachers who were really keen on demonstrations. They're both fantastically enthusiastic about bringing phenomena into the classroom and getting us to look at them and think about them. And I think demonstrations are an incredibly powerful tool in science education, but I noticed that they weren't being as widely used as you might imagine or you might hope. And part of the reason was that some of the classic demonstrations like the monkey and the hunter or the pearls in air, you know, the expertise for how to set those up had been lost perhaps over the years, with, you know, technicians retiring or teachers just never having seen them for themselves. And making my films, I thought was a way of putting those back out there. So yeah, I ended up using the skills I'd learned in television to become really an integral part of what I do as a teacher.
What I'm really interested in here is that you went for teachers rather than students.
Yeah.
And that's sort of one of the things I was thinking. There's that gearing, I guess that sort of gearing idea that basically if you influence a teacher, you by extension influence thousands of students over time. But if you know, working directly with a student is a relatively low gear way of doing it.
I think there's a need for both type of resources. I'm concerned that a lot of the focus, a lot of the resources seem to be focused on serving students directly. And my belief is that if we can provide high quality resources, be they CPD resources or any other type of resources, then ultimately we benefit students in the long term. And, you know, it should be a two-pronged attack. And at the at the moment, it feels very much like it's not, that all the focus from both, you know, learned institutions and publishers is focused on giving students resources. And especially with physics teaching, you know, we know that a large proportion of students in the country are taught by non-specialists. And really, we should be doing everything we can to help anyone who's teaching physics teach it better. And I include myself amongst those people. You know, I would like to be a better physics teacher. I'm constantly striving to be a better physics teacher. But, you know, that would be made easier if there were resources being produced to help us be better.
To be honest, all my time teaching, I never met anybody who didn't want to do a better job by their kids.
Yeah.
And that's the reason people are in teaching, isn't it? Because they want to do a good job for their kids and they want their kids to achieve. And they want to, you know, if you could say, well, you could be more effective in doing that, they say, of course I want to do that. But the trouble is that I used to find that an awful lot of the stuff that was aimed at doing that just really didn't help. I don't know if you found the same. CPD sometimes was
painful. I mean, most of the CPD I've done in my career feels like it's been about things like prevent or health and safety or, you know, how to do this new type of data collection. And there's been very little focused CPD on improving my subject knowledge, for example, or improving the kind of teaching techniques I might use in the classroom. I think, you know, I pride myself on my kind of physics knowledge for teaching school physics, but you know, I know that I could be a better physics teacher if I was being given the opportunity to learn about how to teach physics on an ongoing basis. And I don't think we do that. I think we either have people doing PGCEs or one of the other many initial teacher training schemes. And you know, there's a very brief period at the start of your career when you get some training or education in how to teach your subject, but you know, once you're in the job, it becomes very difficult to continue that learning unless you're lucky and you teach in a particularly easy school, I have to use that term, or you know, a lot of the job is so demanding that, you know, it can be difficult to focus on one's own development. And you know, we're always trying to come up with ways to help students be better students. And I do think there's a real need to help teachers be better teachers, and perhaps we should be looking at that in the same way that we look at addressing students. So you know, it's all very well that people are going to conferences about research in education and so forth, and you know, you look at Twitter and you'd think all these teachers are fantastically keen and brilliant, but you know, I think they're in a minority, and I think the majority of teachers are largely bogged down in their work and grateful for anything that makes their lives easier. And in that respect, I think, you know, what we need is to produce resources for teachers that are easy to digest, easily accessible, free really, in the best of worlds, that help them incrementally get better.
Engage them with wins. I always think that's the way I always think about it. You know, when I'm talking to a busy teacher, I want to give them a win.
Yes.
To here's something you can use tomorrow. And if you fancy it, you know, there is a deeper story
that's
here.
Right.
But yep. For the time being, this will be something you can walk away with.
I think that's exactly the model that we ought to be aiming for. You know, we want to give teachers something that they can apply almost immediately and get a result, you know. So and that could be, you know, here's a new way of teaching motion graphs, you know, try this. Or you know, here's a demonstration that really clearly gets across the independence of horizontal and vertical motion in projectile motion. Do you see what I mean? And that's that's kind of been my approach with the demonstration videos, because as I said, I think demonstrations can really provide one of the most useful tools that we have in teaching science.
Yeah, and I think it's to me the really heartbreaking thing. I mean, there's a lot of it in education, but the false dichotomies that are set up. And one of them is this idea that by giving a teacher a quick win, you're somehow doing a disservice to the idea that there's a deeper story there. No, it's just a way in. It's just another dimension. And much the same way as you were saying earlier about, it's sort of like the aesthetic, and Feynman said this, didn't he, about the aesthetic appreciation of a flower is one thing, but the understanding that's deeper than that about the biology and the things when you do the dissection of your daffodil and all the rest of it, that's a whole different dimension that you can explore, and they're not mutually exclusive. It's not science or art. It's just, you know, and it's not a quick win versus a deeper story. It is one as a gateway to another.
Absolutely. I don't think we as you said, I think it's a false dichotomy, and I think you can show teachers how to do something in class that might work for them, and then lead them towards maybe a deeper discussion about why that particular approach works, or, you know, what the kind of theoretical underpinnings are and so forth.
So, Alan, thank you. Last thing I want to, before I let you go, because I'm sure you've got lots to do, plenty of marking and small children to feed and all sorts of things going on, but I did want to ask you about, it seems to me that there are some encouraging moves, and certainly in terms of inclusivity in science, there seems to be a lot going on. And recently we just heard of Jocelyn Bell Burnell giving away her prize that she was given in order to make sure that graduate students from underrepresented groups that get a chance to go on and make a research career in physics, which is great. But I just wanted to ask you, because you do a lot of work in this area, and I just wanted to ask you about inclusivity in science. Is it moving in the direction? What do we need to do to keep that momentum?
I think the work that's being done on the underrepresentation of women in physics particularly has been fantastic. And I think we're starting to see the benefits of the work that institutions like the Institute of Physics have invested in. However, I think, you know, things like gender and ethnicity and sexual orientation and so forth are issues that we need to think about in a kind of intersectional way. And another important kind of aspect of that is, I think, poverty and class, which often get ignored as factors that might prevent people from engaging fully with education, let alone science. I think, you know, what I'd like to see is more of what social scientists refer to as an intersectional approach, where when we're dealing with diversity issues, we're not separating out gender and race and sexual orientation into discrete bundles, if you like, and that we have a slightly more sophisticated approach. But, you know, that's not to say that the stuff that's being done on gender isn't fantastic. I do think that representation matters. I think the social sciences support that, in my understanding, and that it would be great to see people from all sorts of diverse backgrounds represented in physics when we see representations of physics on television or in textbooks and so forth. And I do think we're starting to win that battle. You know, I'm feeling optimistic and positive about the way the science community is trying to address these issues. I don't know if any of that made sense.
That does make sense. And I was going to kind of take that on a bit, because, you know, we've just sort of, well, I feel this a bit cheeky, but given that we were just talking about quick wins for teachers, one of the IOP's best resources that I think the IOP ever produced was the top 10 tips for how to make your classroom more gender friendly, if you like. And I was just wondering if you could have, you know, three tips you give teachers, let's say, three tips that they could use in their classroom, things that they could do to make their classroom more inclusive and more welcoming. What would you recommend for them?
I don't have three tips. I would just say that anyone who's teaching physics ought to examine themselves really, and to see if that they are consciously or unconsciously kind of perpetuating negative gender stereotypes, if they hold problematic beliefs, that they need to really have a think about that. If they genuinely care about their students, it's something that teachers of all subjects really ought to be thinking about. And so I'll end, you know, this podcast by recommending someone else's book. I think Angela Saini's book, Inferior, is an essential read for all teachers, not just science teachers, because it's a brilliant review and critique of the kind of science that tried to prove that men and women were different, or, and in particular, that women were inferior to men. And I think it's a really important book to read. And so my tip is that, you know, if you genuinely care about your students, then you owe it to them to be educated and informed about these discussions that we're having these days, these very important discussions, and not to, for example, become defensive if you're a male teacher and someone suggests you might be sexist, or if you're a white teacher and someone suggests maybe you hold racist views. It's not helpful if our first reaction to these conversations is to become defensive.
It's true. The unconscious bias argument, which I think was really a revelation for me, was this idea that saying to people, you know, all of us have unconscious biases that we carry. It's how our brains are programmed. You cannot help it. You can't build every social interaction from first principles. So your brain makes shortcuts in the same way it does with optical illusions. And therefore, you have within you biases that you just don't even know about. And you call them out and try and examine them and try and work with them. But there's no sense of blame attached. And this was the one wonderful thing about the unconscious bias training, I thought, for an old white guy, you know, because it's kind of we're often the most privileged in when I say often, we're always the most privileged in terms of the group. So it is good to have that sense that you can bring these out and examine them. And it's not a sense of blame. It's not a sense of you're a racist. It's just that you are carrying with you, whether you like it or not, certain preconceptions that you can't help, and that you should examine those and you should call them out.
I'm glad you're talking about it. I think, you know, we mustn't underestimate the extent to which some people bristle when these topics are raised, and some people genuinely think that we're attacking them or blaming them, and that's not really what it's about. And you know, I would say again that as a teacher, you know, our responsibility is not just to teach our subject well. We have pastoral responsibilities to our children, and part of meeting those responsibilities in the modern world is definitely to make sure that we understand these ideas around racism, sexism, homophobia, and so forth, so that we're really helping to prepare our children for the world they live in, and to give them every help we can to flourish.
Alam Shah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Robin. Thanks for having me.
So yes, Recipes for Wonder. I actually bought that book, and I think we should give it as a prize to the best idea, or the idea that tickles us most, for the ways to teach ... waves. If someone tweets with hashtag TPTP waves, you can of course go on Facebook or Instagram, and we'll use those as well, but hashtag TPTP waves, and we will give you a lovely Alam Shahar Recipes for Wonder book, either signed by Alam if we can track him down, or signed by us, or not signed by us if you like.
He teaches just around the corner from where I work, so I'm hoping I can pop in and get put his moniker on the book, so that'll be good.
Yeah, so it is a wonderful book. I've got it here in my hands, and I know many of the practicals in there, and they're just really simple things you can do.
I just loved Alam's idea that this sort of thing, that every child's first science teacher should be their parent, in the same way that every child's first language teacher is their parent, first maths teacher is their parent, first... And this was the point he was making, wasn't it? That whilst, you know, parents are quite happy to draw with their kids, do cooking with their kids, read with their kids, it's far less likely that they're going to do something sciencey with their kids, because they just feel a little bit put off before. And that's what the book's all about. It's about just unlocking that and making it... something that you feel comfortable doing together, kids exploring science with their parents in a fun way. What a great idea.
Yeah, that daffodil dissection that he mentioned, I love that.
Yeah.
Just, yeah. That's a simple, such a simple thing, such a simple thing. And he has a couple of, he's got one in here that's would do well with our ways to teach .. ways, which you might mention on that episode. So there's just a ton of great experiments to do with kids. Brilliant. And that idea, as you say, of the parents are the first teacher and knowledge capital, and where does it come from, are super important ideas.
Yeah, and if you want to read up more about that, which is it's quite an interesting idea, and it's Louise Archer, got to get this the right way around, used to be at UCL, is now at King's College London, does a lot of work on this. And so if you look up Louise Archer and Science Capital, you'll find out a lot about her ideas about that. And there's some really useful research about how you can make kids feel that science is an area that they can be comfortable and happy and at home in.
Yeah, that sounds interesting. And he actually mentioned, didn't he, the book by
Angela Saini, I think. I don't know how to pronounce it, actually.
Yeah, Inferior. And of course, I went and bought that and I'm reading that. And it's quite... It makes you sad. I've only read the first couple of chapters, but... And she writes well, and she says they sent out applications to be a scientist, and they just changed the names, they were identical, and got the people who read the applications, I think it was for a lab technician, to rank them. And that both the men and the women doing the ranking ranked the women's names lower than the men's names. And you think, oh,
yes,
we've got such a long way to go, but at least we started, I suppose.
The thing is, the thing I find sort of encouraging about Angela's writing and these sorts of things is that basically... First of all, we all have these biases. So it's interesting that she said, you know, the panel, that the women carry the same biases as the men, and they're subconscious. These are not biases that we hold because we're bigots. These are biases we hold because we've grown up in a world and our brain has built up certain shortcuts, inevitably, because that's what your brain does without you challenging it. It just builds up shortcuts and things. So if it encounters scientists, and 99% of those scientists are males, it will think scientist equals male. And that doesn't matter where you come from. So you've got to call out those prejudices and make sure you examine them and get them out in the open. So these are not things that say, you know, you're a bigot because you think scientists are generally men. It's just your brain's built up that picture from what it's been exposed to. And when we were talking earlier about the black hole and, I've forgotten her name. Katie Bauman, we were saying about that. It's exactly the same thing, you know. It's this sort of idea that because they've not been celebrated, because they've not been highlighted, you know, women scientists, it's almost as if the whole of the world of science is deemed to be a world full of men, but it's not. There are loads of great women researchers out there doing great jobs, and so it's a complete fallacy to think that the world of science is dominated by men. It's not. It's the image of it is dominated by a male image, but that's all. And we need to celebrate women in science more and to make sure that their achievements are highlighted.
I totally agree. And it was a bit sad that Katie Bauman did get trolled.
Yeah. And also, I was go back to Michelle Obama's great quote is that haters are going to hate. What are you going to do? You know, and so, yeah, there's always somebody who's on Twitter who just thinks, you know, sad little so-and-so sitting in their room because they're angry about the perceived slights of their life, you know, spewing vitriol at everyone. But you shouldn't let those ever, ever, ever define a debate.
No, going back to Alum, there were a few things there that I'd just like to mention. That I loved it when he said how he was told that practical should be done in silence. And that's wrong. Just like, yeah, that's wrong. Yeah. That's great. I love that minds on as well as hands on. I've heard that before, but I think that
yes.
is really great. And his videos, I've watched his videos, and his Practical In Memoriam is one of his videos. It's a really simple, really short video. And just, again, it blew me away. I couldn't do it straight away, but I sent it to my technician and put in capitals, "We have to do this." And we will do it. And that, of course, inspired me in thinking, what could, you know, we've done this to help teachers. What can we do? Can we make videos, Robin? Probably haven't got the time, but...
Well, also, people would be violently ill. So I think Alum is great. So Alum's videos, and this is one thing I would say, is if you haven't come across them yet, and particularly if you're a teacher of physics who's you're teaching physics, but that's not your main subject specialism, and you're a little bit worried about how to do practice. That's exactly why Alon did those videos. And he comes from a video production background, so his videos are just gems. They're beautifully crafted, beautifully made, and beautifully produced. And they are aimed fairly and squarely at you if you are not confident with practical work. He will show you what you need to do. Yeah, and of course, if you have a video or something that you've sort of a resource that you've created around a practical, and you'd like us to share it and talk about it, we can share that in our podcast notes. And again, a lot of these things, I found since we've done the podcast, there are huge numbers of people producing resources, producing videos, producing instructions and ways to do things, all in isolation, and it's almost like it needs more signposting to those, more ways of finding your way to those resources, and therefore we won't duplicate effort. So if you'd like us to highlight anything that you've done, please do get in touch.
And if you've done something in Waves, tweet us about it and put the hashtag TPTPWaves.
TPTPWaves. That's the one.
So, yeah, we probably talked long enough, Robin, but we worked out we've got 12 episodes left, 11 if you knock off this one, and we've got 5 empty slots. So if you have any ideas for what you would like us to talk about, do get in touch. We've mentioned Twitter, @PhysicsTP. There's also email, contact@thephysicsteachingpodcast.com.
There's Instagram, isn't there, as well?
You can do it. You can do it.
No, I can't. Instagram and something. I can't remember. I never remember it.
Physics_teaching_podcast. So, yeah, there's also a Facebook page, and people have contacted us through that, even through Messenger, although we do take quite a long time to realise that's happened. And you can always contact us through the website, the.physicsteachingpodcast.com.
And we will catch you next week.
Thanks a lot, Robin. And I'm going to press stop. Thank you for listening to the Physics Teaching Podcast, and special thanks to Alam Shahar. You can buy the books he mentioned and donate to your local independent bookstore through hive.co.uk, and we put a link to that in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you next week.